And we are back on Trans Day of Audibility on 3CR 855 AM. It is Sunday, the 30th of March, and it is 1:02 PM. You are listening to our special broadcast. That's right, 6 hours of dedicated trans and gender diverse programming from some of your favorite hosts on 3CR. And this is Priya from Thursday Morning Breakfast. Now, just to begin with, 3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. And 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation, and we recognize their unceded sovereignty. Now, on today's segment, I am delighted to be talking about a topic that has only recently, but quite dramatically, become very near and dear to my heart, and that is the AFL. I know, I am very sorry to everybody who tuned in and didn't expect a footy segment on the Trans Day of Audibility show, but there's a lot to talk about when it comes to gender and sport. And so in today's segment, what we will be doing is having a conversation first up with Dr. Matthew Klugman, who is a research fellow, member of the Community Identity and Displacement Research Network at the Institute for Health and Sport at Victoria University. And we're going to be talking about footy fandom, playing, and gender and biological essentialism, and troubling that in the AFL and AFLW. I don't know, I'm starting to really get in the habit of calling them the AFLM and the AFLW. And yeah, there's still a lot to unpack there because there are some already excellent non-binary players coming up in the AFLW league, but there's a long way to go when it comes to actually having critical conversations about gender and sexuality in the footy. And then afterwards, I'm really excited to be joined by James and Olive, who play for the East Brunswick Eye Gougers, which is an all-gender ability, background and skill level club in NARM's Renegade Pub Football League. I've been a supporter of the Gougers for quite a few years now because my dear darling partner Boots plays for the Gouge. And so it's been just an absolute joy to stand on the sidelines and watch this incredibly trans-heavy team go about their business, sometimes in a particularly aggro way, which I love, and I'm terrible because I totally encourage it from the sidelines, and it is community footy, so it really is just about everybody having a good time. But I hope that you stick around for that. So that's what we've got coming up for you across the next hour on Trans Day of Audibility. Stay tuned, and we will be back to you shortly.
Your boy Race Rage, Jamaica Moana.
Hey, it's your boy Race Rage, and you're here on 3CR, 8:55 AM on Trans Day of Audibility.
It is 1:05 PM. You're listening to 3CR, 8:55 AM. You might be tuned in your car radio. You might be listening via our digital streaming. And if you didn't know about that, you can head to 3cr.org.au/streaming, where you can listen to us live wherever you are in the world. And make sure that you do also check out the website, because there are podcasts of so many of our incredible shows, and there will be podcasts of every segment of today's Trans Day of Audibility special broadcast as well, if you head to 3cr.org.au/Trans Day of Audibility 2025. And now I am very excited to be joined by Dr. Matthew Klugman, who is a research fellow, member of the Community Identity and Displacement Research Network at the Institute for Health and Sport at VU. And their research interests include those who love and hate sport and the intersections of sport, passions, bodies, gender, sexuality, religion, migration, and race. So thank you so much for joining me, Matthew.
Thanks. It's glorious to be here.
I'm just extremely excited to be able to talk to another non-binary person about footy. But not just any other non-binary person, somebody who spends their whole, you know, academic life attending to the footy, but is also a passionate fan. So first of all, congratulations on the win.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a decent start to the season.
Yes. You want to tell everybody about your team?
Yeah. So I follow the One True Faith, otherwise known as the Western Bulldogs. And we won't talk too much about the umpiring, but from a week ago, but Friday night gave a glorious entry into the weekend.
Yeah, I think we'll probably be getting a bit into this and the gender politics that come into the commodification of the sport, because I was reflecting on this before today and I thought it was fortuitous that out of the guests that I've got on, one person's team has a bye this week and the rest of us have had wins, which is great for those of us who gamble heavily with our emotions, of which I am definitely in that category. So Matthew, maybe you could tell us a bit about your own relationship to footy fandom, playing, and your research, because obviously your PhD research really focused on that question of footy fandom. And so I'm keen to unpack some of that in relation to gender and sexuality as well.
Yeah, so I was a migrant. I arrived here on these lands when I was around 4, and one of the kind of key entry points for me was through sport. In these Kulin lands, the most common question for strangers is still, who do you barrack for? And so I was tossing up between some of the successful teams when a person new to the school took me to a Footscray game. And Footscray lost to Collingwood, and I was gone. It was the Dogs from then on. And we lived far out east in North Croydon, so, and my parents were, as new migrants, didn't really get into it so much, so I just listened on the radio. So I'd have these intense Saturdays when all the games are on Saturday, and then either celebrate or ride up and down the street on my bike crying.
Yeah.
So, and then at uni, it continued, and I was, at some stages I was a bit disturbed by how much of my emotions were in football. But then I started to kind of realise the move needed to be to being more emotional rather than less emotional, in our cultures, or the dominant cultures here are so anti-passions in lots of ways. Mm. And so I kind of leaned into it. And so for my PhD, I was fascinated by what is the meaning the game holds for people. And, so many people talk about it as a form of love. So how does that shape people's lives, and what kind of loves are there? And so I kind of wrote or kind of investigated the seasonal passions, of footy fans' lives, as well as looking at the Anti-Football League, which is its own extraordinary institution. And then after my PhD, I became kind of interested in what's the effects of all that passion? What effects does it have around bodies? What effects does it have around gender relations, around sexuality, around race, and these kinds of things? So, that's where I've been going with my work. But as someone who's lucky enough to have a special interest in sport, or I don't know about lucky, but it helps in these worlds a lot. And so in some ways it's a privilege, and then being able to, somehow get paid for that. It's, it's something I remain deeply thankful for.
Yeah, and I mean, I know I and many other people are very thankful for the work that you do to actually keep opening these conversations up around race and gender and sport, because so many of these conversations really in the mainstream are underpinned by, concerning biological essentialism and, racial essentialism as well, which is, and those two things intersect. And I will ask you about that. But I thought, just touching on that that point that you raised about emotion and love, with the emotional investments that people have, it can be really difficult as well to have these conversations about, that might problematize the really binary and cis-heteropatriarchal structure of the leagues. And so can you tell us a bit about the state of play of discourse in contact sports in so-called Australia, and this sort of this issue of gender policing across not just the AFL, but more broadly, because, you know, we always see, you know, every year when there's a media furor about, you know, an AFLW player who somebody is scrutinizing because either they think that she's trans or she is trans, there's clearly a lot of terrible gender politics simmering under the surface.
Yeah, and one of the devastating things about sport, because, you know, bodies, movement, play are such glorious things, and yet sports, you know, start becoming immensely popular here, and the dominant popular culture around this idea that they can turn white boys into strong white men. It's already like the rise of spectator sports around the world is, you know, modern spectator sports are shaped by similar things, and it's already deep, like people haven't explored it that much, but there's this kind of inherent contradiction already in there, because if you need sport to turn a boy into a man, then the process of moving from a boy into a man is already unnatural. You know, and so I think these fissures, these kind of moments, we need to kind of bring in, because, yeah, sport becomes this place of kind of white manhood.
Mm.
And it remains still, you know, such a dominant place of white manliness. You can see it from all the commentators. You can see it from so many coaches. You can see it from who makes the money, you know, who leads these incredibly profitable organizations. But because it's the main language, or one of the main languages of these lands, it's also the one of the rare spaces where you get to contest that, you know, and where you get to have the conversations about race, gender, sexuality. And so I think those are the conversations we really need to be having. And because, yeah, the reaction, the backlash, or the white lash, that's such a strong part of it, is horrible. But when we kind of look into all the aspects of it, it never quite works. You know, sport has never been properly binary.
Mm-hmm.
It's never succeeded in doing what it wants to do, which is why there's so much anxiety around strong women.
Mm-hmm.
It's why there's so much anxiety around trans women, let alone trans men and non-binary players. It kind of unsettles this thing that is held on still so tightly as the space for, you know, creating the dominant men, the kind of men who are to be adored.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's quite easy to talk about the state of affairs in the United States at the moment, where there is this really violent attack against trans people under the Trump administration. But I do also want to bring the conversation back here, because these things are happening here as well. They happen with bipartisan consensus. We're seeing, you know, I'm just thinking about the rollback of provision of hormones to young people in Queensland, pending a review that hasn't begun. And, you know, the gender panics that are happening here and that sort of circulate internationally and feed each other and feed these really harmful discourses that are also, they enable, but they also happen parallel to material violences on trans people. And so I did want to ask you about what we've seen in recent years about body and gender policing, particularly of trans women athletes in so-called Australia.
Yeah, and I think that way of setting up the question is vital, because the anti-trans movements are such a core part of white supremacy programs and ideologies more generally. And so you see, you know, in these lands, of course, that the people leading the anti-trans panics around sport and other things are those who led the anti-halal movements, and kind of go back to the same things. And so invested in this bizarre notion of manhood, where, you know, the men are everything and everyone else is inferior, and the white men, of course, on the top of that. So you get these movements that also frame themselves in ways that are very familiar in these lands, because it's about supposedly saving women's sport. And so you have all these kind of, and you get, you know, it's like the white knights in shining armor come in again to kind of save something. And it goes back, I think, you know, the work of Jordi Silverstein here is really interesting in what she did around cruel care and the work of supposedly saving child refugees by putting them in awful detention, and how that also built on and was reminiscent and echoed what had happened with the Stolen Generations, you know, saving these children by taking them away from their families. And so you can see that these kind of forms of saving, people come in so righteous, but the violence they do with those forms of righteousness is just horrendous. They claim not to see it, but they're not saving anything. You know, women's sports in these lands have had a really strong grounding in being inclusive. You know, they weren't set up by men. They were set up by women, driven by women, and that included all women. And all women have had really strong. And so the people trying to save them aren't involved in women's sport as a rule. They have these notions of women's bodies as fragile, inferior, incredibly breakable, all these things that tie into those white supremacist ideologies of, you know, the white woman needs to be at home having kids, mm-hmm. you know, so that, you know, there's no replacement. And these yeah. forms of powerful bullshit.
Yeah, and I think on that as well, saying that all these conversations tend to come from people who are not involved in these sports at all. And it also comes, you know, sometimes by selecting, you know, a cis woman who has, you know, had an unfortunate experience where they've been injured or something like this, and putting them forward and saying this is why we can't have trans women in the leagues, when yeah. it is, it's just such a ridiculous point to make.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, World Rugby develops these horrendous policies based on a misreading of an article where a cis woman is talking about how much she enjoys playing with a trans woman, and then notes one small injury that occurred where she's had many other greater injuries. And then there's this misreading of it, intentional bad faith, to say, oh, no, she's at risk. You know, these sports are, you know, one of the joys and one of the things that women and gender diverse people seem to find in Aussie rules, as well as, you know, cis men, is the joys of the contact, mm-hmm. you know, the bodily wonder of bodies actually being able to have fun through contact, where they're not being viewed in terms of their utility in this way or that way, or these ridiculous norms of what's attractive and what's not. But it's actually, what can you do with your body?
Mm-hmm.
And how much fun can you have with your body? And the physicality of that, what it's like tackling, what it's like being tackled, and all those sorts of things. So yeah, the people like riding in to try and save something that is not in need of saving is devastating. And then the effects of this are that, yeah, those strong cis women are also questioned. Why are they so strong? You know, what's wrong with them? As if, you know, as if there haven't always been strong women. Yeah. You know, which is one of the things why sport has never been binary, because it's never known what to do with strong women. And so the kind of ideologies of inferiority and weakness then hit against those women who don't fit, you know, so they become very much sexuality becomes an issue, you know, so women who are not straight are often targeted, and a race becomes an issue as well, because it's supposed to be this genteel white woman who's being saved. You yeah. know, and so she needs to be saved from the women who aren't white. She needs to be saved from the women who aren't straight. And she needs to be saved from the women who aren't cis.
Yeah, and I mean, it also, you know, then blurs into this horrible discourse that, you know, criminalizes and aggressively medicalizes intersex people or people with, you know, various chromosomal or hormonal variations. And I think of, you know, Caster Semenya as the yeah. main case here, you know, as a black person who has been subjected to international scrutiny about, you know, the validity of, you know, her ability to engage in the sport that she loves and is trained as an elite athlete for, based on, you know, effectively this medicalization of gender. And I guess I did want to ask you about on that point of medicalization, what is the level of nuance in conversations about gender identity and sexuality within elite footy governance and management here? Because I know that even while the AFLW is miles ahead of the AFLM, and there are some excellent non-binary players, I'm thinking of Tilly Lucas-Rod and Darcy Vesio, there's still a long way to go when we actually talk about gender diversity in the leagues. In the men's league, nothing. In the women's league, still so much work to do.
Yeah. It's kind of horrifying, you know. And as someone who teaches, at university, one of the things I teach is how to teach sex ed. And so, but really what that's doing is actually teaching people sex ed, because they haven't had, and so the kind of lack of knowledge around intersex, the lack of knowledge around gender is just crazy, you know. So, yeah, you know, in the State League of Victorian Basketball, there was a trans woman who was rejected recently by a panel on which one of the panel members was a much bigger and stronger woman, you know. But again, it was around, you know, these fears. It's a problem. And we saw with Hannah Mouncey, who was kind of hounded out of the game, despite the, you know, an excellent player, yet there are images of her, you know, on the web, you know, that are used as if they demonstrate that she's too strong. But the images come from games where Darabin was smashed.
And actually, just to quickly cut in there, yes, the implication is that if you are trans, you cannot be excellent at your sport.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, completely. You know, and the implication is that if you're, not tall or not incredibly physically strong, you also can't be good. And yet, you know, in men's sport, we see so many counterexamples to that. We see someone like Steph Curry, you know, in the Men's National Basketball Association, the MNBA. And I think putting the M back is really important, because it's there, you know. It's only people understood it as men who are allowed in. Mm-hmm. Bringing it into bear. But, you know, you also see it, people like Lionel Messi, you know, in football, world soccer. Like, not the strongest of men, but amazing, you know, or Luka Doncic. There's all these examples of men who, you know, if you look at the record holder in AFLM, in terms of number of games, it's Brent Harvey, this small man, you know. Amazing player, well deserved, but there are many women who are as strong as him. There are many women who are as fast as him, and yet they're never allowed to play against the men. You know, the AFL made a clear decision over a decade ago now, where it was told by a magistrate that it was fine and probably good to allow girls to play against boys till at least 16. The AFL said no, 14's the limit. You know, again, what's the fear? And you can see the kind of investments in a certain kind of masculinity where it's embarrassing for the boys to be beaten by a girl. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily, like in my classes, I have students who were beaten by some of the, you know, like growing up, boys, now men, who were beaten by the best women in the AFLW now, and they're like really proud of it.
Yeah. And I think it speaks to this sort of like gender segregation and policing across the league as well. It's like we need a men's league and we need a women's league.
Yeah.
First of all, there's two genders.
Yeah.
And then secondly, we need to police who can be in these leagues.
Yeah.
And the extent of their participation.
Yeah.
Because as you mentioned, in the AFL, there are so many different body types of players that are required. You have your small crumbing forwards, you have your rucks, you have your tall forwards, you have your centers that you want to be like stocky and massive, but not necessarily that tall. Like there's an interest in bodily diversity within the AFL, but only to a limit.
Only to a limit. And then you see the kind of rules that the women have to have in the AFLW, the women and the gender diverse people in that league, you know. So they play with a size 4 ball. The men have a size 5 ball. Under 16 boys, so what? Once a boy turns over 14 and is playing the under 16s, they play with a size 5 ball, and yet the women are never allowed it. And the size 4 ball doesn't go as far. It's harder to kick accurately because it's got a smaller soft spot. It's more influenced by the wind. All these things that kind of enforce a kind of inferiority that's bullshit. because women should be playing with the same. And then they'll say, well, the argument is hand sizes, because on average, men's hand sizes are slightly bigger. But men have been playing with the same size ball since the 1970s, and the average hand size of women these days in these lands is bigger than the size of the men's hands in the 1970s. So it's just these kinds of this intense desire to limit women, and which then has effects in terms of gender diverse people as well.
Yeah, I think when you put it in that stark detail, it really reveals how arbitrary all of this is. And I guess on that, I did want to move to trans and non-binary folks' participation in community leagues, because we see a couple of, as I mentioned, excellent non-binary players at the elite level. But what have you seen in terms of, you know, levels of participation and engagement, possibilities for that kind of thing in community leagues?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's sport is often such a site of joy and possibilities, but also a site of trauma because of all the things that those people who haven't fitted in have had to deal with, because it creates in-groups and it excludes really powerfully. And lots of the language is deeply misogynist, deeply transphobic as well, deeply homophobic. So for those places where people are able to come back or just go through who are gender diverse, it's amazing for them, but it's also, you know, so difficult as well. You know, and I know with the Masters, the Women's Footy League's been dealing with the fact that some of the fans at one of the clubs have been transphobic, you know, and that's led to a trans woman, you know, or trans women reconsidering how much they're going to play, which is awful. So it still remains a site of, you know, for people, especially people with forms of bodily dysmorphia and that sort of stuff, playing sport can be one of the most healing and wonderful things, because the body is there and being used and celebrated and glorious in those moments. And yet, yeah, so the possibilities for sport and the need for deep inclusion are so vital, but yeah, it unfortunately remains a violent space often. And I think that's why, you know, the promise of things like, you know, we're going to move to those pub leagues. And that's like, you know, I want to play. I'm intrigued by them and kind of, yeah, want to see what it's like, because that seems such an interesting space.
Yeah, and I think it does open up a lot of possibility for different levels of engagement and engaging at different levels of ability as well, where people have felt, you know, some people have felt so categorically excluded from sports because of a binary gender frame that they've never participated in, so this might be their first time coming to it. But just to close out this part of the chat, I wanted to come back to your research on footy fandom and, you know, the complexities that come with gender diversity and investment in a league or team or players whose cis-heteropatriarchal, you know, values, shall we say, constantly let you down. Because I definitely feel this quite deeply on a race level, but also on a gender level. When I see things play out on the field and I'm like, I love you so much. Why are you doing this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's so tricky, and so because it can be so hurtful, and yet sometimes to walk away, sometimes there's a need to walk away, but sometimes to walk away is like, or not walking away is a bit of saying, well, you might be horrendous in certain ways, but you're not going to take that pleasure away from me. You know, I'm going to resist by maintaining that as a site of pleasure, despite the anti-blackness, despite the transphobia, despite the misogyny and the homophobia, so, and all the ableism as well. And I think, you know, one of the things that comes back to is that sport is a site of ceremony. And on these stolen lands, you know, sport has been played for at least 80,000 years. Probably well over 100,000 years on these lands by people, you know, by the traditional owners of these lands, by the Aboriginal peoples and the Torres Strait Islanders, as a kind of, as a form of ceremony, And it becomes this question, like, what if we come back to that, what does that enable? You know, because sport as ceremony is very different to sport, which has to have a winner and a loser in devastating ways. And the winning and losing can be joyful, but it's not all it is. And I think, you know, part of the seasonal life is that a ceremonial seasonal life, you know. At the same time, I find it's so much easier and more enjoyable to follow the AFLW than it is to follow the AFLM. You know, there's so much less anger and hatred in those fan cultures. And, you know, I can watch all those games and delight in them, you know, whereas when I watch men's footy, you know, I want the sound down because of, like, it's so, like, all those things around it. But you know, it's still what's happening there is so joyful to watch, or, you know, enraging or devastating. So, yeah, I think, like, one of the things, and I know the Munanjali writer Ellen Van Nieuwen has been down at Victoria Uni for a month, which has been extraordinary. And one of their focuses in their incredible book, Personal Score, is around what does it mean to come back to notions of sport as ceremony on stolen lands. And so I think, yeah, for me, that's an entry point I'm trying to kind of explore at the moment.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. And I don't know, I was just thinking of the something that I've kept an eye out for over the past few years while I'm watching the AFLM games is the Port Adelaide trans flag, which the Port Adelaide cheer squad has an excellent person who I believe is a friend of a friend who brings a gigantic trans flag. It's got a couple of different queer flags in it. And is just waving that in the middle of the Port Adelaide cheer squad. And I feel like seeing that as a reminder that trans people are here, and also, like, raging and you know, loving and, you know, being deeply passionate about the football. It's just a reminder that we're always there. And
have always been.
And, like, we have always been.
That's one of Professor Sandy O'Sullivan's points, you know, Wiradjuri scholar at Macquarie University, who speaks about the fact that there's the transcestors, you know. They have to have been, you know, because we've always been there. But so those markers of belonging and welcoming are so, so deeply felt.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Matthew. And you're going to stick around with us for a little longer. But to let listeners know, you're listening to 3CR's Trans Day of Audibility special broadcast. It is 1:34 p.m. And we are going straight from 12 to 6 p.m. today with dedicated trans and gender diverse broadcasting and programming from some of your favorite hosts on 3CR with some amazing guests. And we are speaking now, or we have been speaking, with Dr. Matthew Klugman about gender and about race, sexuality in the context of the AFLM/W/NB/trans. And we will be back to you shortly for a chat with the Gougers.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual. Knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope, only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au.
Hello, this is Chloe Allison Escott of the Native Cats, and you are listening very closely, I hope, to 3CR.
Your boy Race Rage, Jamaica Moana.
Hey, it's your boy Race Rage, and you're here on 8:55 a.m. on 3CR.
And we are back for my little segment of Trans Day of Audibility. We're going from 1 to 2 p.m. as part of the 12 to 6 p.m. dedicated programming of trans and gender diverse broadcasters on 3CR. And in my segment, of course, I am focusing on footy, and I'm so delighted to be joined now by Olive and James from the East Brunswick Eye Gougers, which is an all gender ability, background, and skill level club in NARM's Renegade Pub Football League. So thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, our pleasure.
Yes, I mean, it is. Oh, it's so exciting to finally be talking to some Gougers on air, because I feel like this has been a plan that I've sort of had half-baked for a long time. I'm just very keen on it, because I've also been watching you play for a while and been following along, watching my partner play in the league and seeing what an amazing vibe it is. And I've always felt really excited to come watch your games. So maybe to kick it off, did either of you play sports as a kid?
Yeah, I did play a lot of sports as a kid. But, you know, looking back, potentially not the sport I really wanted to play. I mean, growing up, I was a rugby league fanatic coming from Queensland, watched the Brisbane Broncos religiously. But, you know, being raised as a girl, playing rugby league wasn't really an opportunity that was open to me, especially in my family. Like, there just wasn't a choice. And I didn't even know that was a possibility. So I was pushed towards other sports like netball, softball, which, you know, I really enjoyed and I loved playing sport. But I think that I would have absolutely loved to play rugby, and to have the opportunity now as an adult to go back and, you know, kind of live that dream is like awesome.
I love this.
Even though it's footy, yeah. Still great.
Even though, well, you know, you did pick the wrong state to.
Well, I think I love footy now a lot more, so it's worked out well.
I love that you have been able to come to it though, even though it sucks that you weren't, you know, that you didn't have a sense of possibility sort of created for you.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's great that now, I mean, there's a long way to go, but women are seeing, you know, there's the NRLW, AFLW, there's a lot more growth in that area. But when I was a kid, I just didn't even see it. Mm. I didn't even know it existed.
Yeah.
But it is growing, which is awesome.
Yeah. And Olive, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I was playing Auskick until grade six, but that was the point at which you had to go and join the competitive leagues, and that was all a bit spooky. I was definitely a pretty sporty kid and played like a lot of tennis and soccer, but when I was about 16, again, things started just to get a bit intense, and that's kind of when like the C grade teams start to drop off. Mm-hmm. And the more social, enjoyable stuff. So I kind of was playing till around then. I would also go to see the Pies at the G every week with my family. It was a big tradition of ours.
Yeah, well, actually, that leads pretty well into what I wanted to ask you about next, which is whether you've been engaged for a while as a fan as well. So you mentioned that you'd been playing, and maybe, you know, the competitive edge made it less desirable, but nonetheless, you stayed watching as a fan. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was a really big part of the earlier years, but at a certain point, I think I just started to notice a bit of a cultural lack of fit. I've really dropped off the AFLM. Mm-hmm. I don't know who the players are anymore, but if you ask me the 2003 grand final team, I would probably know everyone on it. So I think there was something that happened around 16, which is not surprising, where things started to feel like there was a bit of a mismatch.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and what about you, James? Because you mentioned, obviously, that it was rugby and the Broncos, but did you feel a similar thing, you know, following the rugby?
I think just after school, when I lost that structured, like, sporting environment, I stopped playing sport. I don't know, like, no particular reason. I just put my time elsewhere. And then after moving to Melbourne, finding the Gouge, getting into footy, I'm, like, you know, rebirthed in the sense of sport, like, just absolutely loving it. I've flipped, unlike Olive, I can now name every single Lions player, you know, and I'm just absolutely frothing it.
Yeah, well, you and me both, buddy. we both went to the pub for the grand final. I think it's the first time that I'd been around so many other rabid Lions.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, it was so good. So I guess I also am wondering, in terms of dropping off from fandom and then sort of coming back to it, have you been keeping abreast of conversations about gender and sexuality in sport? And because there's always these flashpoints that that come up, whether it's, you know, Jeremy Finlayson using homophobic slurs. That's the first thing I could think of. The AFLM in particular has these really nasty, you know, moments that happen in time, but obviously signals a much broader undercurrent of problems. And then the AFLW has some incredible non-binary players and representation, but of course, you know, there's still work to be done. So have either of you been sort of tapped into those conversations or engaged with them?
I try not to engage personally. It's too difficult, I guess. So I think I just kind of bury my head in the sand. I love watching the AFLM. But yeah, obviously it has a lot of problems, but everything has so many problems. So I'm just going to take the joy from it. And yeah, obviously I think the AFLW does a lot better job. Love the AFLW, but I mean, everything's got a long way to go. So yeah.
And there's no pure position in terms of these things either, hey?
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I just think, I don't want to say, I think I personally have bigger fish to fry, but so I'm just going to take the joy from the sport and park all the issues. That's what I do anyway.
Yeah.
I think we do what we can, but like at the same time, I remember like when the Olympic stuff happened around Khalif and stuff, that was like actually impactful on our experience playing as well. And you could kind of tell that the wider cultural discussion around gender was affecting how we were experiencing the game. So we do as much as we can. But I mean, another person that comes to mind is Dani Laidley, and her experiences are something that have been really impactful. And then also, I guess like this concept of like, I heard you and Matthew earlier speaking about like difficulties around like non-binary identity and the gender segregation. I think that kind of conversations around that also kind of make it difficult when we're playing in a sport that is historically super gendered.
Mm.
Yeah, I think playing on the gouge though, like it's just such a different experience. So it's just so different to the actual AFLM and AFLW that I don't have to deal with those problems because they don't face us in our competition as much.
Yeah, well, on that, tell us a bit about the emergence of the Renegade Pub Footy League, which the Gouge is a part of, and then the establishment of the East Brunswick Eye Gougers. So where did this all come from, and at what point did both of you join?
So I think the league's about 10 years old, so it's been around for a while. There's, I think, 10 teams associated with kind of inner northern pubs in Nam. And it started, from my understanding, pretty blokey, pretty like have some beers and then play a footy match, which also sounds really dangerous. but it's kind of merged. A lot of different teams have a lot of different internal cultures. And I would say that, you know, we're proud of the culture that we have developed within the team. And that's happened over many years. And there are a lot of people who've come before James and I who really contributed to that. We get to play at Victoria Park, which is amazing because as a Pie supporter as well. the league is like a great opportunity to kind of have kind of all gender. Like the games themselves are competitive, but we're not particularly, like there's not a ladder and we don't like keep track of who wins or not. Yeah, that's like a great opportunity that the league presents. The Gouges have historically kind of been the ratty team. But that's great. And like sometimes we get trainings that have like half of the players are like trans or gender diverse, which is like really like special and unique, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's this amazing league where like it doesn't matter what your skill level is, it doesn't matter what your gender identity is, everybody's welcome and everybody thrives in that environment. Like you've got people who have never kicked a footy before and you've got people who have come from club footy. I think other teams have like ex-VFL players. And it's still a really competitive environment, but it's still really safe and everyone has fun and everyone's included and it's just amazing.
Yeah, I always feel like it's kind of funny watching the Gouge play on Pride Round because I'm like, well, like you're sort of just representing every single round.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the fact that, you know, there are cis men and cis women that play on the team, but it's not a team environment that fosters anyone being like a hero, right?
Yeah, I mean, a huge part of it is recognizing that we're not just in it to win it. There's a lot of work that's put into kind of identifying the differences in body types and height and all of those kinds of things that are, I mean, a really great way to kind of disentangle the concept of sport from gender when you're actually just like lining up with people who have similar body types and just recognizing that. It also just kind of allows for a bit more of an association to like what is actually about safety. Like, is a trans woman playing footy going to be unsafe? Like, no, it's all about how people use their bodies. And that's something that we spend a lot of time focusing on. I think that's really great.
Yeah, like the language used in training is always amazing. Like, it's always an err on the side of safety situation, even though we do play full contact. And yeah, it's just like, oh, we're doing this drill, team up with someone of a similar size and skill level as you. And like, that means there are people of different genders mixing all the time, but it's in a comfortable and safe way. And like, I mean, you've been to our games, there's full tackling, there's full contact, and like people do get injured, but no more than, or probably a lot less than other footy comps. And we all have fun and it's very competitive and very safe. And yeah, I just think it's amazing that we can achieve that.
Yeah. And I love the fact as well that the nature of the team and the culture of the team has developed a sort of like a positive notoriety where there are so many people that are affiliated with the Gougers that come to training but might not play. Mm. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about the club culture and what attracted you to joining when you did.
Yeah, so I moved to Melbourne in January 2020. Not a great move time. In the very beginning of January 2022, I still hadn't really made much of a queer community in Melbourne. And I'd heard about this football team that had lots of queer people on it. And I was like, well, sounds like a good opportunity to maybe meet some other queer trans people. I'd just come out as trans myself. As soon as I arrived, I met like multiple trans people. I've met Kieran, who's like my best mate to date. We were both just at the start of our like kind of trans journey. And yeah, I was just like, I knew this was for me. I, you know, combined sport, one of my favorite things, queer people, another one of my favorite things, socializing, exercising. Like, it was just for me, ticked every box. And yeah, I haven't stopped ever since.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think like a lot of people on the team joined through friends of friends. And I think it's really for a lot of people an opportunity to kind of identify that their friend might really benefit from being around some trans community. And that's kind of what happened for me. My friend Sam, we had met on a dating app, but had been good friends for a year or so. And they'd been just telling me, like, you have to come, you have to come, you have to come. And eventually I did manage to gather the courage. And once I did, it was all in. It was such a great experience. It's an environment where I, you know, have been messing around with pronouns the two times that I've changed my name twice, and both times that I first used those names were at the Gouge, as kind of like, it's just like an excellent also just like space for play with gender, I think. I think there are a lot of things you can say around about pronoun circles, especially in workplaces and stuff like that, but this is a really amazing example to me, I think, of like what exactly a pronoun circle is supposed to be. At the start of every training, we go around, do names and pronouns, and you just notice your friends kind of playing around with their pronouns and like, oh, that person's been she, her for ages and now they're trying out she, they, or like that they, them is now going he, him. Like, it's like a really great kind of way to just like in a really low pressure way, not having to just kind of jump all the way in and like come out at work and like I'm trans and you know, take on all of that. And that's really difficult for people, but it's just this like opportunity to mess around with it and people like sometimes like return to what, you know, they used to use and enjoyed trying that, and that's beautiful as well.
Mm. Yeah, like if we take that back to what we were discussing some earlier, and you know, that horrible move in terms of Queensland around trans affirming care, you know, those, you know, that space with puberty blockers is supposed to do exactly that, like take the pressure off, you know, because these, you know, these things are so complex and yet so central, you know, so a space where you can actually just figure things out and it's fine, you know, to be this or you know, to say, oh, you know, what's it like doing this? And that sounds glorious. It also sounds like starting like that every time is kind of also a moment of ceremony that kind of grounds everyone in terms of who you are and what the space is.
Yeah, it is. It is really beautiful. The clap at the end is always great. And then I think, yeah, usually someone says, yeah, great names and pronouns. And that's like a good way to finish it off.
Yeah.
I mean, it is also, I think it's also a really beautiful way to open up space for things that we, like as trans and non-binary people, don't get to talk about that much, which is that gender fluidity is something that everybody expresses, no matter what your gender identity is. And to be able to have spaces where you can be fluid in your pronoun use, in your presentation, in your use of name, without having somebody be like, oh, but does that make you really, you know? It is, yeah, I think it's really important. And something I wanted to also touch on before we wrap up is footy being a physical contact sport and maybe your reflections on gender and embodiment while you're playing and training. And you touched on this a bit with, you know, the matchups and as you go through that. But what's it been like to sort of be your full selves on and off the field?
Oh, I absolutely love it. Like I would never have dreamt myself being able to play like a full contact tackle sport. You know, I didn't do it as a kid. I wasn't just going to pick it up. I didn't envision myself picking it up as an adult, and then now I have this opportunity and I'm like, wow, this is awesome. It's very gender affirming for me as a trans guy, and yeah, I love it.
Yeah, I think I really connected with what you were talking about earlier with Matthew, where I think I've got a negative thing to say and a positive thing to say. if we're good, it's an issue. When James and I started in the same season, we still probably lost maybe 70-80% of our matches, and then in the last couple years the team's really improved, and we have noticed an uptick in physical response and also I think maybe cultural response, and there have been a few more tensions, and I think ultimately like a lot of our players also recognize that it's dangerous for trans players out there. Not all the other teams have the same culture as us. It is a great opportunity in the league, and so many of the teams are really great. But when you're playing against like 40 people on the other team who, you know, don't know you and often will make assumptions about identity and stuff like that, I think that a lot of our trans players have an experience where there's something confusing about us to like cis players, and it kind of confuses their internal systems, and there's this kind of subconscious difficulty with it that then often unfortunately means that a lot of our trans players get hit the hardest because the like blokier guys don't really know where to fit us in and how hard they should be playing against us. So that's like one part of it. But at the same time, I think that being able to identify that it's about bodies and bringing that sense of self back to your body rather than gender as a wider concept, so many of our players, I think, have spoken about the opportunity for movement and connection with your own body in the context where like transness is so often associated with dissociation from your body. That has been a really beautiful experience. Yeah.
And I would just add that I think that, in terms of our trans players being targeted, it also happens when some of our more skilled women players are really skillful and really good. The men, some of the cis men in the other teams, they don't know how to deal with it. And so they start using their, you know, strength to overpower them that in an unsafe way. And I think that's just a broad issue with masculinity and men not being able to appreciate like skill and size and how they can be safe in that environment. Like, I think we do it well in our team, but some of the other teams, maybe there are some men who, yeah, can't recognise that. And so the skilled women and trans players get targeted a little bit.
It seems that's so fascinating and still distressing, hey, because it almost sounds like perhaps there could be a moment of the pronoun circle at the start of the games. Mm. But I also think, like, what does a world look like when being beaten by someone, you know, who's more skillful than you? Because if the men are beaten by an AFLM player, they're like, oh, wow, you know, I played against this person, they destroyed me, you know, how proud am I? But if they're beaten by an AFLW player, it's still, you know, it ties into that. Like, there's still a shame associated with it, but there's no need for that. And the ways, yeah, like, because I think that point about, you know, like, yeah, gender fluidity, like, these things and kind of like I do a bit of 2D theory with my students, like trying to show them that masculinity and femininity aren't, you know, like you can be both, you know, or you can have you can have little of it of either. And I show them prints, and, you know, because we start off with songs and stuff, and then I pick out a jock and I say, well, is Prince a manly man? And they're like, no, but Prince's life was around, you know, the seduction of women. And so, you know, hyper-masculine on that. But he adored beating masculine men at basketball, you know, as this very femme-presenting man. And when he, you know, a couple of obituaries were written by trans women after he died about how, sorry, about about queer women. A couple of lesbian women wrote these obituaries saying that he gave them a way of pursuing women and kind of that wasn't hyper-masculine. Mm-hmm. Like, it was really interesting that they'd kind of identified with that femme aspect of him, while the other aspects of him that, you know, were kind of stereotypically masculine. So,
yeah. Like, the space for gender and play, like, within the context of sport, I think is so precious to be able to explore. Mm. And I am so deeply devastated by the fact that we actually have to wrap up, because I feel like we could go on for a very long time. But I just want to thank you all again so much for joining me today, and for talking about your journeys with the Gouge, and Matthew, for talking about your research and your work. And will you be joining?
Yeah, I want to join the Gouge now.
Yes, come, Matthew.
I'm so keen. As soon as I heard you speak about it, I was like, oh, that's my team.
Yeah, let's go.
All right. Thank you all.
Thanks, Priya.
Thank you.
Thank you.